Okay, we're going to go ahead and get this afternoon's workshop started. The two presenters today are Blaine Connor and Lana Mallette, correct? Dr. Connor is an anthropologist and educational specialist who's worked for NIOSH since 2014. Past projects have included underground mine emergency self-escape training, responsible person training, and heat stress prevention training. He currently leads a project investigating the heightened risk miners with less experience in mining or at specific mines or tasks. He is currently recruiting participants to discuss their onboarding and transition programs. He's accompanied by Lana. Lana is a social scientist at NIOSH. She holds degrees in anthropology and sociology from the University of Kentucky. She leads a team working to improve the safety and health of miners through better training, techniques, and strategies. Her team also develops products to communicate with the agency's research finding. Her past experience includes developing and conducting full-scale emergency response simulations in virtual environments. Pardon me. How about a warm welcome for our workshop? Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us this afternoon. I can see some of you. Some are hiding behind the technology over there. So we're going to be talking today about judgment and decision making and in emergency response situations specifically. We'll talk about mining, but some of these ideas, of course, would be relevant to any emergency situation. I'm going to talk just to open things up, and then I'll switch things over to Blaine. He's going to talk specifically about responsible person and preparing people who are in that formal role of responsible person at a mine site. Then we'll switch again, and I'm going to talk a little broader about strategies for emergency response decision making, and then about a particular training module or product that we're developing right now. So the presentation will come to a couple different transition points, so we're not stopping when that happens. We're just transitioning to the next step. So as we're moving along, if you have questions, feel free to jump in and throw those in. This isn't a formal talking head kind of presentation. We're very comfortable with just taking your questions, getting your feedback as we go along. As the slide shows, emergency response, there's a lot of confusion at beginning of responses. It's not often that there's not information, it's that there's a lot of information, but is it the correct information at the correct time, and do people know what to do with it when they get it to make the optimal decisions? Those of you who are in the audience, some of them are my colleagues from federal government, from MSHA, from NIOSH. Others may work at mine sites. Others have contracting positions or occasionally there. But if you're ever at a mine site, then this kind of issue is important. It's important to what's going on with you for your own decision-making capabilities. Because if something happens while you're at the mine site where you're at work one day, are you going to know for yourself how to make optimal decisions? Are you going to know how to prepare the people you work with if that is your responsibility? Are you going to know how to talk to your colleagues if as things don't go well? These are the kinds of things I'm hoping you'll think about as we go along, sort of what is your role in terms of an emergency, whether your role is just to protect yourself because we're in this building and something goes wrong, or whether it's to be responsible for a number of people. So feel free to ask questions or think about it from your own perspective as well as the perspective of a mine site where you work or a contractor who you work for, or whatever that might be. So as an emergency unfolds, we're going to start with the very beginning of something might be wrong. Now, at that point, you don't have those formal responders there. You have whoever happens to be there at the time. So their decisions are going to be critical in terms of getting things off on the right foot. Are they going to start things in a way that bring responders to them appropriately? Are they going to start things in a way that protect them optimally? At some point, you're going to then get to the point where you do have the more trained mine rescue team or volunteer fire department or whoever it is, your EMS crew coming in, people that have that additional training, and then moving all the way up to a full-scale command center, which is much further down the line. So when we're thinking of decision makers, we're thinking of all of those people, from the potentially endangered miner to the dispatcher who gets that communication where they need to go, all the way through to the command center leaders and people who are having to deal with those great big issues that you think about. So open your conception of emergency response. We're not talking about just those people in the command center. We could potentially be talking about you if you happen to be on site when that happens and you're making the decisions at least for yourself. So as I said, we're going to first talk about a particular role, and that is a responsible person role, and Blaine's going to go through some information about the responsible person. And then we'll kind of broaden it out into those broader decision making and how to prepare people and how to talk about it. Does anybody have any questions before we get started or before Blaine gets started? How many of you actually are at mine sites in a routine basis? So a couple of people. How many of you are just, you know, sometimes you do contract work or you do sales or something? And then government officials? A few of those. So I'm hoping that each of you will find something in here that will come from your side. Now, those of you working at mine sites and also who work with those at mine sites, when we talk about the particular product that we're developing right now, we're in the point of development that we're looking for places to field test this. We've worked with one mine in Ohio and field tested it with their mine rescue teams. So we're looking for additional, it could be annual refresher training, it could be mine rescue teams. As I go through that part of the presentation, I'll talk more about what that means and see if there's someone that might be interested or if it might be a nice match as we go along. So we'll fill that in when I get to my part. But for now, I'm going to turn this over to Blaine, and he's going to talk about responsible person.
Thanks, Lana. Is anyone here unfamiliar with the responsible person requirement for the coal mines, underground coal? I'm going to assume that some of you may not be, so I'll just go briefly over it. There's a role designated in the standard for a responsible person. The responsible person is responsible, as Lana put it, for your safety. They're the ones that are going to take over in the early part of an emergency. And until they can stand up that command center, they're the ones whose job it is to make sure that everyone in the mine can get out safely and then the event can be handled in a good fashion. So the standard 30 CFR 75-1501 spells out a number of requirements, what the responsible person is actually responsible for. And this includes initiating an evacuation, getting firefighting response together, contacting federal agencies, establishing a fresh airbase if it comes to that, and all these things that are listed here. The standard came out in 2008, and MSHA provided for mines IG-110, or Instructional Guide 110, which is responding to a mine emergency. And this gave mines a compliant set of materials they could use to prepare their responsible persons. All responsible persons have to be trained annually and on what's going on locally at their mine, as well as general principles of mine escape and mine disaster response. Something about the materials, though, they're kind of designed for any type of mine. They contain all the materials you would need if you were had to run everything yourself. But the responsible person does not have to individually do everything within the standard. They just have to see that it's done. So different minds might have more people on staff, different shifts. They're going to be able to delegate those responsibilities to others. And those who train the mind responsible persons can use these materials. They can supplement them any way they like. They can train them in using different orders, different activities. And we were curious at NIOSH how the different minds were meeting this requirement. Were they, who were they designating as the responsible person? Was it someone underground? Was it someone on the surface? And we didn't have answers to those questions, so we designed a small study to get some of those answers. The study involved interviewing mine safety professionals, but also involved going out to mines, looking at the facilities they used for their emergency response or their training, such as, you know, communication hubs or things like that. We looked at the emergency response plans and any other materials they had as job aids that would be in use during an event. So I worked with, I don't know if any of you know the name of John Gallick. He's a retired mine safety professional. And through his entree, we were able to talk with safety professionals at six different mines. We wanted to get a broad range of opinions, so we spoke with people that were, you know, at union mines, mines without unions, those out west, east, central, and whether they had longwall or not. And we weren't just asking about the training that they were prepared for during those annual classes, but also who are you selecting, right? As I mentioned earlier, were you selecting people underground, a mix? What were the principles you had in mind for those? And what other aids were you using? We were hoping to see if there were some interesting practices or good practices that we could share them out with the industry. And that, in fact, led to an article in Coal Age and some presentations at industry conferences. So that's what I'm going to talk about today, is what we learned from this study. And hopefully there'll be some principles that are they're useful to you, and it'll feed into the broader discussion that my colleague Lana Mallett was just mentioning. So the first order of business is, well, who are you selecting to go to this class and for the responsible person that you have to have trained? And what we found was, as one of the interviewees put it, if you were just trying to be compliant, you would say, all right, I need a go-to person and a substitute for every shift. I'll have, and so could that be four people, six people, and now I'm fine, now I'm compliant. But all the mind people we spoke to trained more than that. And they were, their go-to person was, in all cases, in all those six cases, was someone underground, like a shift foreman or something like that. But they would have in their training the communications personnel, dispatch, someone in the communication hub. And I would say, oh, is this person, you know, is this person your number two on the list or your number three on the list? And they said, no, generally we wouldn't want that to be the go-to person. We would want someone who had that mind knowledge from underground to be able to get them out. But they recognized that when dividing up the responsibilities of the responsible person, which involves contacting the federal agencies, state agencies, getting information out quickly, coordinating information on the surface to organize that response, they want that person, that communication hub person, to be on the same page with the responsible person. And having a really well-prepared communication person who understood those responsibilities would allow for a smoother response. Not very surprising, but we were glad to hear that those people were involved. Some mines didn't have them in the same class, and they said, well, we would take some of that same content. We'll slip it into the training that we normally do for that communication person. So that was one finding, that they generally wanted someone with the underground knowledge, but they worked closely with the surface personnel. The other part relates to the curriculum, and you saw earlier that long list of responsibilities, all the things they need to make sure are done in those early stages before we can have a command center set up, before we have our full complement of people responding to the emergency. And in all cases, again, the safety personnel I spoke with said some of these items we don't want to spend over much time on, because it's never going to be something they're going to do. That's going to be further down the line. By the time it comes to this, there'll be people who can better do those responsibilities, such as taking a gas reading or setting up a fresh air base. That's not going to be something that the responsible person hopefully would have to do at these mines. These weren't the smallest of the mines. Instead, they wanted to devote extra time in the time that they had for training to the things that came earlier in the disaster, so they could make sure that those decisions, those critical decisions about evacuation and firefighting, could be handled early. Another thing that that came out in the interviews was, since they had these people together and they were thinking of emergency response, just as we would hope, they were thinking of emergency response broadly. So they weren't just looking at the standards and what was required for the responsible person training, but they were using it as an opportunity to say, let's practice coordinating with outside personnel. Let's invite emergency rescue, helicopter rescue, firefighting, first aid, leadership training, any other kind of training. And they would see this as a great opportunity to provide their emergency coordination personnel with those broader skills. One thing that came through was the importance of having procedures. Because the responsible person doesn't have to do all the things themselves, and in fact would be delegating the response, would likely be underground, being able to turn to a set of procedures in the emergency response plan, rip out a page and say, here, this is you, go to the gate, you're in charge of security, or go take a reading. Here's how you set up a reading. Here's the materials you need. Having a set of materials, the equipment they would need, the forms they would need, here, you go do this, was a critical part of how they envisioned the response. And I remember one interview with a safety director. He said he was at an airport. He was on his way back to the mine, and he got contacted. And they said, well, there's a fire. And he said, well, I'm in this airport, so just follow the procedures. They trained to the procedures, and so they followed through on that event, and everything came out safely. And what that drew out is changes in the mining industry, how the technology and some of the laws have led to mines becoming the sort of place where procedures can get you through most of the disasters. That if it's a fire, if you go in and you have a lifeline, if you're not on rail, if you can just go back out the way you came in, you can handle the response by procedure in many more situations than had been the case decades before. And so they drew that contrast for me. But pointing out how procedures can make response run more smoothly, they did point out other occasions when you wouldn't be able to follow a procedure. Sensitive things or more difficult and more challenging problems. Just as a simple example was having a conversation with MSHA when they get on scene. Mines want to be able to say, here are the actions we've taken. We want to demonstrate that we're doing this sensibly and we have this under control. How can we talk to MSHA and show them that we've been taking the responsible steps and that we are aware of the situation underground? One mine would say, turn that all over to the safety director. One would say, provide this sort of information. But not something, a very sensitive conversation that you could handle by procedure. You'd want to think about what is the MSHA person going to need to feel comfortable in the response and that they have a good partner working on this event before the command center is set up. And I don't know if some of you have seen a graph like this. This is from the work of James Reason. Is anyone familiar with that person? He drew an interesting distinction between, you can see in the far right where it says skill-based performance. Those are sort of by rote. You can train for those repeatable things. Think of putting on an SCSR or some kind of escape device. Things that they become habitual. Those are learned behaviors. You don't have to put a lot of thought into those. And you can train with those with practice. You train to automaticity. So it's just automatic what to do. We know what to do in those situations. Going towards the center, you have rule-based performance. And that's where something like a procedure or a job aid, things I've been discussing, would come in handy. I don't always take gas readings. I don't always do security at the gate. But here's the emergency response plan. There's a page in it for that. I can just go and follow step by step what these procedures are, and I'm covering what I need to cover. I'm taking down the information I need. I'm not going off on a tangent. I'm not wasting time here or there. But the third, and the box, I guess, in the bottom left, you see it says knowledge-based performance. Those are the more challenging situations. My colleague John Gallick on the project, he said the distinction between a fire and an explosion. If you have an explosion underground, your ventilation could change everything there. Paths that you might take out would be blocked. That's going to require a different level of concentration, different level of thought, and decision making to ensure a better result. Far different from something more run of the mill that might be better addressed by a procedure. So how do we train people, the responsible persons, they're going to have to be responsible for the response, to handle those more complex events? Are we able to train for that? Or is that something that comes from experience? Well, we believe that tabletop simulations are a good way to train for these more difficult and challenging situations. And three of the minds that I spoke with were using tabletops, and they use them in different ways. So all of these ways are valid ways to do it. Some of them would be more appropriate and might be more appropriate to a mine where you work. So I thought we would talk about those, understand the differences, and that would sort of feed into the later conversation with Dr. Mallett about simulations and decision-making training in general. So the first approach was to use the exercise as a way to organize a presentation. So what do I mean by this? In order to be compliant with the responsible person standard, all those elements that were on that first slide, there's maybe 11 different items, they all have to be covered. And so one of the minds looked at those responsibilities and designed a scenario, a fire underground, and made the class go through it. So they would say, all right, you learn of a gas reading that's off. Now what do you do? And they would click through the different steps, invite answers from the trainees, and proceed through the disaster in that fashion, hitting every element. Do some decision-making, hit the element. Do some decision-making, a little bit more instruction. So it was a way to cover all the material. And the thinking of this safety director was, sure, we really want the go-to responsible person to really know their stuff, but we want to think about all the people that could be around to support that person. So what he told me is, and I've wrote this quote here, I'd like to see everybody do it, meaning the responsible person training. During what I call the responsible person's window of work, that one half hour to hour until the manager takes over, the more people that understand what's going on, the better chances you have of all those things that the responsible person is responsible for happening. So he wanted to have a class full of people, not just the go-to responsible person, but the communication person and those people way down the line, 3, 4, 5, 6 people down. So one approach, organizing the training, hitting all the elements that way. A second mind pursued it this way. They saw it as sort of like a capstone exercise. So there would be more straightforward or discussion-based instruction into the responsibilities that the responsible person had. And then they would use these exercises to sort of challenge and consolidate the learning. So after you've learned everything you have to learn, we've hit all the elements that are required by MSHA and the standard, now let's give you a scenario and see how your decision-making works. Because it was done at the end, it gave them the flexibility to throw in more challenging situations. This mind threw in a surface exercise. That's not something a responsible person by statute would have to do, but this mine happened to have both surface and underground operations. They could do that because they'd already hit all the elements. And so they could make these more challenging, and there are other advantages to doing it that way. I noticed that Virginia provides some materials for their responsible persons, which took the same approach. There's a third approach, and this was again, drawing the distinction between what has to be required for compliance purposes versus how this is going to play out in their mind. So for compliance purposes, they want to have many people trained, and this was done by self-paced computer training with instructor feedback at the end. So everyone took the same training. Do you understand the elements of the standard? Let's take this test. Oh, you've missed something. I'm going to go over that with you. Now everyone's in compliance. We've got that covered. But this safety directors wanted to prepare those go-to RPs, the ones that are going to take charge in the really difficult events, the explosions or things like that. And they would pull out those people most likely to be in charge, the ones you'd hope would be there when something happened, and give them a kind of a MERD-like exercise where a number of trainers would play parts of MSHA or of a trapped miner, contacting on the phone, and make these trainees work through the scenario very difficult. This gave the trainers the ability to gauge how well their trainees were doing and modulate how difficult the training was and create other challenges in that way and lead to a successful event. So three different approaches. The challenge of the third approach and any of these tabletop exercises is they take time and resources to put together and to deliver well. And if you ask anybody, safety personnel, do they have such time? They're strapped for time. They're pushed to get a lot of things done, and they would like to refresh their training, but once everyone's gone through, boy, they really want to refresh it, but can they? Do they have that time and those resources? So one way we thought could help is what resources does NIOSH have or does anyone have to put into help them refresh? One scenario that is common and was alluded to was communication during an emergency. Information's not coming straightforward as it might in an exercise, but it's coming in a haphazard fashion. Some of it might be inaccurate. Can we throw in a module within a responsible person training that would help the responsible person understand and practice how to effectively communicate and get the information they need to respond in a good fashion? This is just my illustration here of how communication could happen in an exercise. And especially if everyone's communicating on individual devices, we can get a lot of different messages coming in. And as a responsible person, we have to sort through the noise and practice it. NIOSH has this training on emergency communication, the communication triangle, which could be the basis for developing some scenarios that could be used to help other responsible persons work through this. Another element where we think the training and preparation of the responsible persons could a place to improve it would be to focus on the assessment. We have a training, and we make sure that they understand the elements of the standard. Do we have any follow-up assessments? And we didn't see a lot of formal assessment programs in the mines that we spoke to. And yet we know from training literature, people are going to forget what they don't use, and certainly we don't hope that there's disasters and all the time that they have to use these skills. So how else can we make sure that they retain this information? And something as simple as walking in underground with the people that will be the responsible person and says, hey, what if you just got a call right now? What would you do? Drop in a scenario, something like that. And then hearing the response, if you're the safety director, for example, and working together on whether that is an effective response or not, where there that might show a place to do some more training. Putting this all together, for those of you who were at the mines, we came up with this set of conclusions for you or ideas that you could have, and so I'll just summarize them as a way of summarizing what we learned from the responsible person research. One would be to have those service communication personnel and the underground foreman practice working together. That's a key dyad, a key duo or pair, and we want to make sure that they're able to function well. They both understand what has to happen in those early stages. That's when things can go really right, or that's when things can be set up to go really wrong. The second is recognize where there's opportunities to have job aids and procedures, forms, packages of materials all set so that everyone knows where to find them, and they can help out in that early stages when help is most needed, before the formal response is on scene. The third was that mines should be aware of their own circumstances, how large they are, and say, all right, these are the most critical tasks. I want to spend a little extra time on these elements of the standard because these are the ones that are really critical, and we're going to have we want to make sure that those are done very right. Covering all the elements, adding that extra time where they think is needed. And fourth here, we have to challenge the most likely responsible persons. This is well done with the simulation exercises as discussed. And last here, we have two. The one is to devote the resources to refreshing the materials. The stale materials, when you've seen that same video 1,000 times, it just doesn't have the impact. So being able to get new content, even new modules, new things, it takes the resources, it takes the time to put it in. Please do so. And turn to other resources to help yourself. And finally, assessment. It's one thing to see the training done, to get the form signed, but then follow up a little after with a delayed assessment to see how much is being retained by those people so they can use it when that emergency strikes. And that's what we learned. So any questions about this responsible person study that I can answer at this point? Stunned into silence. All right, very good. All right, well, Anel, thank you very much. I'll turn it back over to Dr. Mallett.
So Blaine talked about specifically what mines are doing with their responsible person training. I'm going to talk a little more generally about decision-making training, and that would include the responsible person, but could include anybody. When we think about making decisions, your first thought might be that the way people make decisions are they look at all the options, you know, what might I do next, and they think about the pros and the cons, and then they pick what would be the best option. Well, that may seem the most optimal, but that isn't necessarily, research shows us, how people make decisions. They might make the decision by, I have to do something, the first thing that I come up with that I'm confident will work, I go with that. I don't look any farther. They might go with, this situation that I find myself in, I have been in a similar situation before, or I have seen someone else be in this similar situation in a book I've read or in a class I took, and this is how they did it, and it was successful, so I'll go forward without doing any further exploration. Now, any of those could work for you, or they might not, but these we have to think about how people make the decisions as we're trying to prepare them and maybe give them some ideas and tools of how to broaden their thoughts and how to make sure that they take everything into consideration when they're trying to figure out what's going on next. I mean, if they're deciding what they want for lunch, we don't care so much. If they're deciding something that has to do with a mine emergency where their lives, the lives of their colleagues, the future of the mining operation, we want to make sure that they are well prepared for those kind of decisions. Unfortunately, though, or maybe fortunately in terms of we understand this, sometimes in emergencies there aren't the correct answer. You know, you get in a training class, you have the person standing behind the podium, and you think they're going to tell you this is how this should be. And if we could do that for every mine emergency, that would be wonderful because we could train people, do this every time, and it's going to work. But that's not the case. It's a moving situation. You don't know exactly how things are going to unfold, in what order, and how that's all going to come about. So sometimes there just aren't any correct answers. And that's one of the issues that we were trying to figure out. How do we train these people if we can't say always multiple choice answer B is correct? And so as I go through this presentation and then toward the next phase of this presentation, I'm going to talk about a new tool we're developing that addresses that head on in thinking about there might not be a correct answer always. Our goal is the same. Can we get them out there safely? And when we develop materials in a story-based, a narrative form, We're looking for something that's going to engage people, make them think about what if I was in this situation, have that, you know, if their scheme of decision making is going to be this has happened in the past and this looks something like this, if we give them more and more examples of those kinds of situations, they'll have a broader range to choose from in what's going on next. Some research with firefighters and the people in charge of command centers at firefighters is where they determined a lot of people did that kind of decision making. You know, I've seen a fire like this. I've seen a situation like this. This is how it was handled. This was the outcome. So we're looking for people to get, not just sit in the classroom and listen, but can they get engaged in thinking about what's happening and thinking about what it would be like for them to be there? Now, you can go all the way to one scale of high-tech virtual reality. There's some very cool things coming out, you know, fully immersion. But there's also the cognitively immersive, as we call it. So not necessarily they're seeing it with their eyes through their VR glasses or whatever, but that they're thinking about it and thinking and imagining themselves in that situation. So when we're in a classroom and we're testing our materials and we hear one of the minors in the class go, oh boy, boys, we're in trouble now, you know that even that they feel like they're part of the story. So this is the kind of thing that we're looking at to give people an opportunity to think about their decisions and to practice making decisions. So a couple ways we do training. One of them, the thing that we'll all be used to if we've ever taken a multiple choice test, you have what we call linear storylines, linear simulations. Blaine talked a little bit about this, and I'll get to that in a minute, but it starts from the beginning and you go right through the end of the story, and you stop and you can ask questions, and as you can see in this case, there's one green answer, there's one correct one. The others might be sort of wrong or all the way wrong, but there's one green, yes, you're correct, go forward. And that gets you all the way through the training. Now, I'm not saying that that this is bad. I'm saying that this is one way you can do it, and there's pros and there's cons. So the first simulation or first option that the mining company that Blaine talked with did, they did that linear. They told a little bit of the story. They asked some questions. There was a standard related to that that gave them their answer. They moved on to the next part of the story, and it worked its way all the way through. Now, what's good about that is that it's very standardized, and everybody who takes that class is going to get the same information, and they'll get the same information every time. So if you want to make sure that it gets covered the same way every time for every person that you're training, this is one way to do that. It's also relatively simple, so if you have people that don't have much experience, you're giving them the content piece by piece, and they're going to learn a piece and be tested or practice. Learn a piece and be tested or practice. And this one, in the case of this mine that that Blaine visited, it was standards-based, legal-based response. So it was easy to see how it matched with the compliance regulations. Or a second way, which is also linear, that he talked about was you had that content, you had your studying, you talked about it, you had that choose the right answer, green is go, and then they had a more guided simulation. And a guided simulation, you start with the story, and then someone asks a question, and the instructor or the subject matter expert or whoever it is that's there working with you gives you the answer, yes, you're right, you should go forward. You know, yes, the mine rescue team has done the correct option here, move them forward again. So again, it's a very guided and instructor-led kind of experience, going from one beginning to a defined end, where you're going to have your instructor doing debriefing, which is always a critical part that sometimes gets forgotten about. If you're doing a full-scale, all-day kind of simulation, and you're tired, and it's getting late, and it went longer than you planned, sometimes that instructor debriefing gets a little bit of a short shift, but that's a critical part of the training, is giving people an opportunity to reflect on what they've learned and reflect on decisions they made today. But then there's another kind of training, and this kind of messy thing called branching, that you can do branching with computer-based training, you can do branching think of if you've been involved in a full-scale mock or a MERD kind of experience, because there's not just four, they don't give you four options and let you pick from them necessarily. It's a more naturalistic, I'm going to choose, and if I choose to take a gas reading, I'll have that information, and then I can make another choice. If I don't choose to take a gas reading, I won't have that information. I can choose to call the mine rescue team or not. And your simulation gets really messy. Now, the nice thing about that is that's much more like what's in the real world. The difficult thing about that is it takes a lot of resources to manage, and it's much harder to make sure that everything flows as it should. I've been to one mine site in particular that did a full day where they had everyone from local EMS to their mine rescue teams to everyone involved, and it was a huge undertaking. Now, great experience for the people involved there, but you certainly aren't going to be able to do that every day. You know, that's just not something you can routinely train. Now, that's one example of what Blaine talked about, the way to make sure you cover everything. Because in branching, if I decided to never take a gas reading, I wouldn't have practiced that skill. But where Blaine's one talk was, or one mine, they did all their instruction, the things that they were required to do that they wanted to make sure got covered, in a completely separate session. So they did that first. Everybody there covered it. Everybody there was included. They had their tests, which was the green is go kinds of answers. Then they did their simulation. So now I'm practicing. Now, if you don't absolutely hit everything, it might not be as critical. But you can guide as an instructor to make sure, well, hey, by the way, did you know you didn't take gas readings? These kind of simulations are much more flexible. And if you have an excellent instructor, they can gauge them from the least experienced person, because they can make sure that guy that you, they give them kind of hints along the way, to a very experienced group where you don't give them any hints and they are only assessed at the end. If they get themselves in a big trouble, that's their problem. So these are, again, difficult to manage, difficult to write, but very rewarding in terms of being more naturalistic. So that's something to think about. So we're going, okay, we have sort of these two ends. We have this linear, multiple choicey kind of thing that's easier to develop, easier to administer. It covers all your compliance, all the way to this very messy, choose whatever you think you should really be doing, naturalistic, practice more real world. What can we do that might be somewhere in the middle is what we were looking for. So we're trying something new. As I said, this is a brand new product, and I'll show you a little of it in the next phase of this talk here in just a little bit. What we did, one of my colleagues, Tim Bowerly, was doing a dissertation on decision making, and he gathered information from subject matter experts in emergency response and found out from a story, kind of the linear model we had before, what would they do at certain important critical points along this, in this case, mine fire escape. So we got a group of miners, they're escaping from a mine. He picked out points that he thought were critical in terms of what decision I make at this point is going to mean the difference between my safety and not, potentially. And he asked multiple subject matter experts, what would you do? What do you think about this? And he gave them that multiple choice option as well and said, tell me what you think about this one. Tell me what you think about this one. So he didn't ask them pick one. He said, rate number one for me. Is this a good idea or not? Rate number two for me. Is this a good idea or not? So now instead of one go for green, you might have multiple greenish ones and you might have multiple reddish ones based on the subject matter experts' ratings. They sometimes, all of them went to one, and sometimes all of them went to the other. Sometimes they said, this is just kind of a mess. I guess any one of these three might work. So what we've done here is we still have the linear control in terms of the story's going to go step by step, but instead of saying pick one and then right, wrong, move on, what we're doing is looking at sort of shades of, and I'm going to make you look at all four of them. So we can't, remember at the very beginning I said sometimes people will find the best answer or the first answer they come to and they'll go, this answer's good, I'll just go. in this case, if that answers A, they pick A and they move along. We're forcing them to look at A, B, C, and D and evaluate each one of them. So that requires your trainees to practice evaluating options. It also opens up a lot more decision and discussion opportunities within your classroom, because you're not just discussing the right one anymore. Now you're discussing all of them. What's good about them? What's bad about them? So we took this, the first product, I'll back up a little bit and tell you a little more about this product. It's underground coal mine fire evacuations. We have seven scenarios, seven stories. In each case, there's a crew somewhere in the mine and something happens. And there's a series of decisions that they're going to have to make to try to get themselves safely out of the mine. It's a computer-based delivery, and if the technology allows, I'll show you later. We had a little technological glitch earlier, so that will be not as smooth as we would all like, but we can make it happen. We took the first ones to a mine rescue team in Ohio for them to test it out for us. And the way we do that, if you haven't been involved with any of our field testing, is we have a new product. Before we ever give it to everyone, we take it to whether it's a mine or a university classroom or a IMSHA class at the academy or wherever an appropriate group would be. And either we run it as the instructors or their instructor runs it and we watch. And we get their feedback. And if they say there's something wrong with this, we fix it. Or if we don't like the way it goes, we fix it before we ever release the product for all of the rest of you to use. So this mine in Ohio was very gracious to say, sure, come on up. And Blaine and I did the teaching that day. We had mine rescue teams. We had their mine rescue team instructors, a state inspector, or state mine rescue team trainers, is who it was. Someone from IMSHA happened to be inspecting that day. He decided to join in with the fun, and the mine wanted their communications people to be involved. So that's what the classes look like. And when we started, and this is one of the classes, as you can see, there's a little, they're paying attention and being involved in the session as we go. We had ask that we could do at least one of these training modules. At the time, we had three completed. We trained for 2 days. In the first day, or both days actually, we said, okay, you've done one of these. We really appreciate it. We want all your feedback. And they were not shy at all in telling us what they liked and didn't like, where there was some issues. And then we said, okay, well, you know, this is great. Thank you very much. The trainer said, do you want to do another one? And we said, that's completely up to you. You know, this is all you've signed on for. And the mine rescue teams both days said, no, let's do the other ones. They did three of them. Now, that might not be a formal evaluation criteria, but in my book, if they say we want more, I'm happy with that day's work. So we went through. We found something that we didn't like about the way it flowed and went back to the office and fixed it. So now we have the new and improved version, and we have all seven scenarios. Each one of these was based on real events. So when they go, heh, that could never happen, we could pull up the IMSHA report and say, not only can it happen, but it did. And even if this happened a few years ago, people aren't all that different. Some of these happened before the 2006 Miner Act. So yes, there are changes. So that's part of the training. You know, okay, yeah, they had this situation in their world. How is it different in your world today? And why is this law important? Because what did it do that makes your situation safer than what they had to face in that time frame? So the people in the room had a lot to say about that. It stimulated questions and experiences from their own backgrounds, and they had a lot to say about that as well. So as we said, I'm making the transition here. We're ready to field test the next site. So if anyone hears of anybody who might be interested in some emergency response training that we could build in, it takes half an hour to an hour to do one of the sessions, depending on which one you pick. We're looking for that right now. Uh, And so I'm going to, as we switch, I'm going to show you what the product looks like, but I just stuck this up here because it's important information for you as we, as I grab my laptop so we can get that set up as well. Or Blaine, you want to do that? So here's how it works. The product is called Emergency Decision Making Underground Coal Mine Escape Scenarios. As I said, it's computer-based. Right now, it can either be straight off of a web page, or there's a deployment method that doesn't require you to have internet. So depending on where you are, one of those might be better for you than the other. It starts out, and I'll give you some handouts here in a second to show you what these look like. You're going to have a mine. It's going to tell you the information about that mine, where are we today kind of information. And then it's going to and tell you some section information. And then it's going to give you information about where that mine, where those miners are in this particular crew. And as you can see, it looks very much like any old multiple choice test you might get. So, but option A, it's not saying option A, is this the one you want to pick? It's saying option A, rate it. Do I, somewhere from agree to strongly agree, that this action will help the group's chances? So your first option, is this going to help the group's chances to get out more safely? After you have rated each of them, you get all four of them. So now the instructor can go back and go, well, here were the four options that we just rated. Let's talk about them. Let's talk about, you know, why did you rate them the way you did? In our case, with the field test we just did, we had small groups do it first. So each individual rated theirs and talked to their small group. Then we got to this page, and all of the groups said, oh, well, I rated this one high or this one low, or, you know, obviously we'd do this one. And that's where the group class discussion took place. The first time we did it, we thought the discussion would be at the end, just to tell you how important field testing is, but the class wouldn't let us. They wanted to talk about it here. So they kind of pushed it, and we said, well, obviously that's the natural place for discussion to take place. So then the next step is, here's what you rated, which is on the left, what the class decided to rate. On the right is your expert ratings. So that's what our SMEs told us about that same product. So now it's not right or wrong. It's compare me to the experts. How well did I do? Now, if I have something way off from what our experts said, I might want to figure out why. And then if I match the experts, we can go from there. Again, another place for class discussion of, well, why did the experts think this if I didn't get that? And the next step is, what happened in real life? Because as I said, these are based on real events. And so the next piece is the group in real life, in this case, called the dispatcher and told everyone to get out of the eight-face parallels and then ride on the Jeep. So, or this one particular person. So that sets you up for the next question. So now the next question, that person will have went to that place and done that task, and it'll give you another set to rate. Oh, so just so you can see what this is, I'm going to hand you a couple maps just so you can get an idea of what it's like. If anyone's interested in a short version of what this is about, I have some a couple handouts too if they want to take them with them. Okay, hopefully our technology will cooperate. And if it doesn't, if any of you'd like to see, and even if it does, if any of you'd like to see this in more detail, I'll be hanging around today, tomorrow. I have it on my computer. We'll be happy to look at it. Because for some reason, my laptop doesn't like this connection very well. The product, as I brought it up, it's guided through a computer-based training. Yeah, an individual could sit and do this by themselves. So if somebody misses class and you want them to cover the material, that could happen. But they do miss the discussion with other people, and they miss the feedback from the instructor. So it's not as rich an experience, but it certainly is an experience that would get them the material that they want. The way we really set it up is that this product is for the instructor to lead that class and to use the software to work their way through it. Blaine, you want to be the fingers? Because I can be at the mic or I can be at the computer, so it's our choices. So you choose one of the minds, and in this case we'll choose Adelaide, just so you can see what the layout is. And then that mind map you have, you get the mind information, and you can choose one of the sections, one right off, eight left. Oops. And that'll give you the section information. It's going to tell you stuff about the crew. Go forward, please. Yep. And then as you see on the upper left-hand side, it tells you what's the conditions at this time. What's the visibility, what time of day it is, whether or not the crew has an SCSR donned, and how far have they traveled from the time they got the information. So it's setting the stage. As your scenario goes forward, as your storyline progresses, that information up in that upper left-hand box will advance and give you the information about the environment, SCSRs, distance, and time. So that's sort of your keeping your linear. Remember we talked about a linear story? That's going to keep your linear story in line. This information down is sort of telling you the story. The belt goes down for the second time. The mine phone rings. Dispatcher says, go get your men out of the section. Then the phone goes dead. There's some problem with our communication. Three workers go up and tell the face crew. All of them are warned of the situation and are gathered at the dinner hall, which is their designated meeting spot. That begins your story. Now, from there, you'll, over on the right-hand side, option A. Sorry, I thought this would work better than it is. Walk out the secondary escape way. So at that point, people get to not decide, is this the best option? That's what we typically do in these kind of multiple choice events. We're not asking you the best option. We're saying, if I were to walk out the escape way, would this help my chance to get out safely? So I'm going to rate every single one of them. So we'll just, I'm not going to go into detail here because we're kind of talking about how it would work. But let's say I agree with that. So you click it, you move forward. Now, what if I instead walk out the primary escape way? Is that going to increase my chances of getting out safely? So let's strongly agree with that one. What if I left the section via rail-mounted man trip? Would that increase my safety? And I'm going to strongly agree with that and tell you that in almost every situation, no matter who your subject matter expert is, no matter what you're talking about, that's what they're going to tell you from all the work that we've been doing. Ride is the answer in almost every situation. There's a lot of things that are much grayer than that, and that's what we're trying to get to here, some things that, you know, is it strongly agree? Is it really agree? Is it strongly disagree? Maybe some aren't as black and white as that ride or walk option. Then the next one is walk out the belt entry, and let's just strongly disagree for no other reason than example. So here's our four options, the things that we've now thought through, all of them, instead of just coming up with one and going on. We've thought through them all four. We'd have a discussion with our trainees about which one did you pick? Did you like this one or that one? And then click the next one, and we get to rate our options versus our subject matter experts. So as we said, leave via rail-mounted man trip. We said 1, they said 1.2, so almost everybody was universally in agreement of that. And the expert ratings for the others are a little different. So it's not absolutely right, absolutely wrong. And then we have the next piece. What really happened in the real world during this event was they left the section via a rail-mounted vehicle. And now you go on to the next question. Now the visibility is a little over 5 feet. It's a few minutes later. They still don't have SCSRs on. They've moved 3/4 of a mile. They've ridden the man trip. They encountered smoke. Some of them started passing out the SCSRs just as protection. And now we're going to go to this next point and repeat the process. We'll get 4 different potential options for what they should be doing. We'll rate each single one of them until we get to the end, where then there's discussion at the very end that says, in this case, here's some high points that you want to make sure you cover with your class. So at the end of the day, the class covers particular points. And for each one of the 7 scenarios, there are things that get covered. And in the instructor's guide, it tells you, if you want to make sure you cover whether to walk or ride, or you want to make sure you cover what if somebody leaves the rest of the group, or what if somebody gets hurt along the way, then choose this particular one of the 7 stories, because that information will get covered in that particular scenario. So I think we won't bother with this flickering technology, but if anyone here is interested in looking at it in more detail, as I said, I have it on my laptop. This is not ready for prime time because we're still working on it. As I said, we've made our changes based on our first field test. We'd like to take it out to another mine site in the new version to make sure that everything goes smoothly now in the new revised version. And then we're hoping that we'll go through the approval process and have it out for everyone to use soon. So anybody questions? Okay, well, we know that we are between you and the bar. And so we'll be here if you have questions or just want to talk about training, what we do, how we field test. We'll be happy to chat about it more. And otherwise, enjoy the rest of the conference.